Welcome to Once Upon a Story, a public health palliative care podcast from La Trobe University. Welcome back to Once Upon a Story. This is our sixth and final episode of our discussions about my PhD research into Eastern Palliative Care's biography program. My name is Carly and I was the one doing the research, and my co-host is Crystal, and I'll get her to introduce herself in a moment, who is involved in the biography program. And we've been chatting about the elements of research and biography and all the things involved in all of that. And today is a question and answer format. So we'll be going through a few different questions that have sort of come up as we've gone throughout the podcasting episodes and the chats that we've had ourselves. So Crystal, hi.
Hello, hi. Yes, my name is Crystal Wallace and I've gone through a title change at Eastern Palliative Care. My new role is called Program Development and Volunteer Services Manager. So still very much involved in the volunteer space. That is my first love. But I'm also now under the privilege of being able to work in other areas around program development. And I guess I'm excited about today because we're actually going to be able to hear what it is the listeners would like to know a little bit more about as we go through these questions. So the first question that I've got for you, Carly, is what did you learn about conducting industry-based research?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I've thought a lot about this over the time, because I have to say when I first started I really didn't get the concept of what industry research was, or at least I think I understood what it was, but I didn't realise that was sort of the term for it. But I think one of the things that I've really learnt is that it's very specific to the project and to the organisation that you're working with. So obviously I was working with you guys at Eastern Palliative Care, and I was doing a very specific sort of project, but I was also working in a very unique time going over COVID, you know, those early, so it was 2020 to 2023. So all of those things make it really specific. But I think what I did learn most was that you need to have really good connections with your industry partner, which primarily was you. So I was really fortunate in that way, is that you were already on board. And I think that was really key, that it was, it had come from you guys, the whole idea. And so you were already invested. And I think that was such a big thing to have to begin with, and made such a massive difference to what I was able to do. And it just meant that you guys were really great in giving me information about the organisation, because I was an outsider coming in. And there's this sort of mix of me being the supposed researcher and you guys being the industry, and how do we combine all those things together? So it was definitely a learning process for us all.
Yes, it was.
But definitely having good people to connect with and work with made a huge, huge difference. And, yeah, it was really important.
I remember one of the challenges that we were facing too, though, was how the academic space interplayed and spoke to the industry space. And sometimes there were competing agendas or even competing timelines. I'm thinking about, you know, even as practical as how often does the ethics committee meet at Eastern Palliative Care, and that was a lot less than say what was happening at the La Trobe University end. And what will the industry allow or see as ethical as a compared to say what the academic institution might. And in some cases the industry was going to be a lot stricter than what the academic scenario was.
That was really interesting, wasn't it, to notice that because I was also very lucky to have some really great supervisors on board. So they were already involved as well, and I guess invested in that way. And you don't necessarily know how they approach research compared to how the industry approaches research. And I guess because La Trobe, the supervisors, research is what they do, they're sort of more across what's advancing in research at the moment, whereas industry is working in the industry and it has to be very practical and now based. And yeah,
especially so that, I think especially when there's budget involved.
Yes,
and
health,
you know, and health. So yeah, EPC put money in towards this. Did you feel constrained around any of that? In that, were you free enough to choose your own project design and your own question, or was there constraints that you had to actually meet?
I think there was both. There were constraints, obviously, and I did feel a little bit embedded to the process because I was like, yeah, they have put money into this. I want to do a good job and I want to do something that is worthwhile for EPC. So I guess we need to make clear that there was always a very strict sort of separation between industry and the research. So I wasn't doing – EPC didn't tell me what to do. It was very much left up to – me and my supervisors to do that in discussion. So it was independent research. I wasn't going in there to prove anything that you'd asked me to prove or anything like that. It was a very separate process. But that is where the complexity did happen, in that we still had to work alongside EPC. And as you said, things like ethics, the ethics committee meets irregularly compared to how often the Latrobe is set up. They're set up to pass ethics all the time. So that was a hugely different process. And they are, yeah, they're obviously much more used to that. So they offered feedback that was worthwhile, but was perhaps different to what EPC did. And we managed to do something that was suitable for everybody because we talked about it. But I think the constraints that I felt was I was very interested in doing something creative or narrative-based from the very beginning. And I guess the constraints I felt was that I didn't know what that meant at the beginning. I didn't really know how much I could really do that. And that was partly just because I was coming into a space that perhaps I didn't have a lot of experience in, both research and palliative care. So I was learning as I was going as well. But also there's a timeline. And as much as you say you're 3.5 years, that sounds like a long time. When it comes down to it, it's a massive project that became even more massive than I could contain in those years. It really could have gone any number of ways. Quite genuinely, that middle year in particular, I remember supervision meetings, I'd rock up and we'd talk about stuff and I'd make these lists of the directions that I could go that could be further developed, and there were just so many options. And so in that way, yeah, there were constraints because obviously I did feel that there were better and let's not go better and worse, but helpful and less helpful options around that. And some of that simply was going, this is the first research that's been done into EPC's particular product and in this particular manner that I can see in this way. And so I feel that it would be really most helpful to do this type of research because it forms a foundation and that it could then be built on by other people. So that did constrain it in a way, but not in a really bad way.
Yeah.
Just in a almost practical way.
Correct. And I remember too, we had to have, it was almost like you needed an interpreter.
Yeah.
Because and it needed to be an interpreter that could understand both sides. Mm. So I think it helped with your creativity, the fact that I have a large investment in that space as well. That helped because you and I knew what we were talking about. Then the fact that I was already a trained nurse working in health meant that I could sort of interpret what was going on over there, and we could work out a way that what we were trying to look at would make sense within the health field, which tends to be very quantitative driven, and we'll touch on that later on, rather than interested in sort of creative concepts and outcomes. And I think what you've produced by the end of that 3.5 years was an amazing piece of work, which kind of joined the two together really well and effectively.
That was something I had to work out a bit, to find that medium of going too far one way or the other, but yeah, trying to combine it. So you were very helpful in trying to find that middle ground, definitely. Yeah. Perhaps we'll move on to another question. So I'm going to ask you now. So you run a training package. So maybe in a moment, as part of your answer, you could talk about some of the training that you offer. And I know that you have people coming to you and asking about the various types of training that you offer. Your program is quite large. What about people who have much smaller organizations or smaller budgets? What do you recommend if people don't necessarily have the resources that you already have for other organizations? Because this is part of this research. We'd really love to help other people expand this. So tell us all about the training and what you might advise.
Yeah, look, that's a great question and one that we get all the time because we're approached by organizations all the time. One of the answers that I immediately say to people is not to be put off by the fact that EPC's biography program is as large as it is. Because what everyone has to remember is we had to start at one point, and we started with two biographers and one client, and it was no more complex than that. The other thing was that although we had had training from New Zealand, essentially we were starting in a vacuum. It wasn't here at EPC. I mean, it wasn't here in Australia. And so we were creating from the ground up. So I'm hoping that that's going to start to sow seeds of hope for smaller organisations. I would advise them to say it's one step at a time. Take the next right step. It's as simple as using your smartphone as a recording device. There's free transcription software on the internet. If you've got a printer, you can go to Officeworks to get things bound. Look for grants, government grants, and also philanthropic grants. The concept of biography is so easily relatable that it's not hard to sell it as something for other people to invest in. And then, fortunately and luckily, there are organisations like us who are there to support through training offers. So we can train people's trainers, so train the trainer. We can train people's biographers for them. They go through exactly the same training we give our biographers. And we can also mentor organisations or staff members. And if people just jump onto the Eastern Palliative Care website and go to the education tab, they'll see all the various offers that are there. You know, that's way more than EPC ever had. It's way more than I had when I started working there. When I started 12 years ago, I didn't get a handover on this biography program. It was like, here you go, sink or swim. So you can do it.
Yeah.
My next question that I've got for you that's come in is, what would you do differently next time?
Yeah. Again, I have thought about this a little bit. In a way, there's lots of things and nothing. Partly that's because you don't know the first time around all the things. So there are things that if I was to do this project again and I was able to give myself the knowledge that I have now, obviously I would streamline my research from the very beginning quite differently, because I did do quite a bit of research in that first year into areas that I never got to really fully develop. I mean, it was great grounding. It really helped my understanding, all of that. But I would still go back and say, maybe just spend your research time on these things a little bit. Read these, but, you know, spend the majority here. But you don't know that from the really early time. And also you do still have to work within the confines of the PhD process and, as we already said, the industry process as well. So I wouldn't necessarily, I'm happy with the way things happen. Like, there's nothing that happened that I go, oh, that was absolutely terrible. So I wouldn't change any of that, really. It would be smaller things. It would be how I organized. I've learned how to organize things differently. I'd set up how I wrote notes or all that sort of stuff differently. So if I was now to go into another large research project, I'd certainly have different ways of working next time. But they have more to do with how I structure my research process and just honestly, knowing the ethics process is a great leap forward. Understanding that a lot more now would change things as well, because I'd have a better understanding about how to write that and how to research what's required for the different elements. So that would change. But like the basic overview of it, I'm pretty happy with what I did and how it related to all of you guys at EPC, the volunteers, all the different groups, because there are four groups of people is quite a lot. And so I was really trying to work with four different groups of people, but I wanted to work with each group in a very similar way. I didn't want to highlight one or the other from the research, through the research process. Now, in the writing of it, I have sometimes emphasized particular groups as examples, but that research base was very similar for each group. So for each, in that way, I'm pretty happy with that. But yeah, you always learn. You always learn and how to do research.
You would probably take more regular breaks.
I might take holidays a bit more frequently.
Say no more. Say no more.
Yeah, it can get a little bit stressful. So maybe I wouldn't. I don't know. I'd like to say that perhaps I wouldn't get so stressed the next time, but maybe I'd just get stressed about different things.
That makes a lot of sense.
So the next question's for you, isn't it? And it has to do with, so this is a really interesting question about biographies and what you actually keep. So could you explain a little bit about the biographies that you do or don't keep? Do you keep biographies? Do you submit them to a national archive? Wouldn't that be great? What are your thoughts about that if you do or don't? How do you relate to that question about how you keep palliative care biographies that people have actually written?
So we have an agreement with the client that we'll only keep them if they give us permission to use them in training. And we only keep the soft copies, even if we can use them in training, for 13 months. So everyone's biography, irrespective of whether we're using it in training or not, we will keep for 13 months. And that's because we know families and clients sometimes might lose things, particularly after death and the house is a mess and you've got everything going everywhere. So we'll keep that there. Once that happens, everything gets deleted. The reason being, we need the client. So we've got to remember it's all about the process. So we want the client to feel free to share with no repercussions, ramifications, because if they think that something is going to be used in another way later on, like, lodging it with the National Archives, immediately you're going to change how you tell your story because the purpose has changed and you'll start self-editing. And for us, the process of biography, allowing clients to talk about whatever they want, wherever they want, however they want, no matter how confronting, and even if it doesn't land in the story, allowing them to have that space to process in that way is of paramount importance. So for us, no, it will never get into the National Archives, although I totally get it because being in the privileged space I'm in and seeing, thinking in 100 years' time, gee, what a resource that would be for academics down the line.
But the biography is given to the client.
Correct.
And so what happens, it's up to them. It's like they own it, essentially. It's their story. So what they do with it afterwards is up to them.
Correct. That's all up to them. But most people are not going to think about concepts like that. And I'm not even sure that there's an avenue for people to look at. So it tends to stay just within the families as a legacy document.
Yeah. Mm. But it raises really interesting questions, doesn't it, about the ethics of storytelling and the types of storytelling that there can be and that there are.
Yes. But, and you and I touched on it. I think it was the last session where we talked about your story changes according to who the audience is going to be.
Yeah, and when you're telling it and to who you're telling it to.
Correct.
All that stuff. Yeah.
So the next question I've got here is for you. Death and dying is, for most people, a really confronting space to be involved in. How did you deal with being involved in such an intensive space and topic for 3.5 years?
I was asked this question by someone and I was actually really surprised about it because I hadn't thought about that for such a long time. And I realised that it probably is quite an important question to consider, both for myself but also relates to the volunteers and for yourself, the staff working in that space. And I think there's a few things that relates to this is that, first of all, I guess I knew what I was going into. I knew that it was palliative care. And so as soon as I knew that I was doing this research, even before I stopped working at my other job and sort of things had transferred over, Before I knew anything about what it meant or anything like that, I grabbed from the library as many of sort of popular books as I could about palliative care and grief. And so I read a few of those books, and not to say that there were hundreds of them, but, you know, a couple of them, that sort of began to prepare my headspace for it. So that was one, I guess that was one way of preparing myself, knowing that I was going into that space. The other, I think, important thing is that I am just the sort of personality where I'm going to be actually more comfortable having a intensive conversation with someone about things like death and dying than I would be walking into a crowded group of strangers and having to introduce myself.
Yep.
So there's a personality in that I'm quite interested in having those sorts of conversations, and I'm willing to go, yeah, hi, how are you? Let's talk about the process of grief and how you experience that, particularly within a research context. So if I know this, it's not like I'm walking up to people in the street and doing that. I realise that's not appropriate. But within the context, I was quite happy to go into that. And it is, I recognise that it's more for the volunteers. That would be, you get to know people in such a deep way that perhaps it's more intensive than I experienced it, because I didn't necessarily follow up with people in the same way that volunteers, they have an ongoing relationship. And so the natural process of the research was for me to meet people, talk to people, and then almost walk away, not from them or their story, but I didn't necessarily have a great deal of contact with them. And that was the same whether they were clients or whether they were volunteers. And so the process for me, it was the same across all the groups.
Yeah.
And so it didn't feel it didn't feel that intensive in a way.
But
I think it's an important conversation, because it would be very important, particularly for volunteers.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because when I first started, even as a nurse, firstly, it was an area that I was always drawn to. So you're right, there's a personality thing. I'm much happier speaking about the deeper things in life than I am. Like, please don't ask me to have those surface conversations. I can't stand it. So, yes, personality, I think time also helps you become a lot more comfortable within that kind of space. And I can see that with our volunteers. When they first start, it's a little bit tougher, but then they start to relax into that space and they get it. You get more comfortable with all of that. I think also context, you're right. So early on, it was like, oh, I've got, you know, I feel like I'm carrying all this death and dying load. But now 12 years on, for me, it's boundaried. So this is my workspace. And then when I leave, it's not. And I'm not going into that. Mind you, actually, as a family, we talk about a lot anyway, because that's just how we are. But we train our volunteers a lot around boundaries, around your emotions, things, little things you can do, even taking your name tag off signals, right, that's where I leave that. Now I'm moving into my own life again.
Yeah, that is actually a really good point, that trying to have a clear delineation between work and not work. I tried to be quite clear with that myself, even though I was working from home most of the time, because I was working at home, that I needed to be particularly careful about that. And then the whole COVID thing made that even more important. And not to make light or less of this process at all, but it almost was interesting that it was during the COVID period, because there was something about that was distracting in a way. Like, there was a lot of other stuff going on in my life. This was not the total, even though it was my main focus in my work and all that sort of stuff, but there was a lot of other stuff happening in life. And so I very quickly realized I needed a way of, this is work and this is life, and being able to deal with that. Yeah. And I think the other thing that I was just thinking about that did actually help is that because I was researching, and also, again, personality-wise, I did a lot of writing, and I do think that genuinely helped a lot, both for myself and as part of the research.
Yeah, fantastic. The next question.
Your next question is for you, and I think this is a question that you may have said you don't get a lot, but I've had a few people ask me this about the process, is do you release the voice files between the volunteer and the client as they're telling their story?
We do occasionally get requests from carers for the voice files. Always happens after the client has died, and usually the request is phrased around, I'm starting to forget what their voice sounds like and I don't have any records, can I please have the voice files? Now, for a long time, that's been tricky. And when I say we get requests, it might be one a year. So we're publishing 100, so it's tiny, tiny. Yeah. The reason it's tricky is because of what we referenced before. It's a confidential process, and we've made agreements with the client that the information they share with us is not going anywhere else, even to their closest family members. So we don't know if what the client is saying is going to in some way harm, land badly, trigger, etc. So we've got a duty of care for the carer as well. We also have considerations around the volunteer. Would they be happy with their voice file, their voice out there ad infinitum for all eternity? So we've had to do some clever thinking around that. And one of the things we've brought in probably in the last year is creating just a very short 5-minute voice file right at the beginning of the process. We say to the client, this is about us testing our equipment, which it kind of is, but it's also getting them used to the idea of their voice being recorded. And we ask very inane, light questions. So it'll be like, you know, if you were an animal, what would you like to be and why? Or, you know, things like that. And it's just a 5-minute snippet. And then what we do is we now put that onto the USB that we release with the written biography. So that will hopefully tick everyone's needs and boxes and protect everyone as needed as well.
That's a really great creative answer to that question, like a response to, yeah, something that people might ask.
Yeah, because it's been heartbreaking in the past. Because normally we delete the voice files very quickly after we've used them. And it's heartbreaking to have to say to a wife who's in her bereavement, I'm really sorry, we don't have it. We just don't have it. And to hear the break in their voices on the other end when they realise it's another dead end for them is, we needed to do something to make that request.
Right.
So back to you again. The next question that's come in is why would you do qualitative research and not quantitative? What can we learn from qualitative research?
Great question, and so difficult to answer in some ways, but also I think really important. So from one level, qualitative rather than quantitative is simply I personally could not do quantitative. It's not my background or skill set. It's also, I have to say, it's also not necessarily my interest, as much as I'm so happy for other people to do that and to learn from them and to totally take on board what other people have done. I don't think it's something that I'd be great at anyway, but also I don't have the experience in it. So it was never something that I really was set up to do, but also because qualitative research tells us something different than quantitative research can. And there's different spaces in which each are very relevant and they do different things. And they can, in fact, probably work side by side extremely well. Like you could do quantitative research into the biography program. But it would come back, I think, it would tell you very different things to what mine has been focused on. And part of the reason for me in particular to emphasize the narrative quality in particular was that the biography program is about storytelling, and it seemed to me most obvious that you would do research that incorporated storytelling into that. And part of what I really like about it is that it presents it potentially presents quite a holistic view of things. And by that, I mean that if you're going to do quantitative research, often that means that you're doing research that's really specific, pinpoints particular areas. It looks at something in depth, which, as I said, can be really helpful, and we learn a lot from that. But the biography program is a particularly relational program, and there are many moving parts. There are many people involved. It's very dynamic. As much as you have a process, EPC has a process, it's a very dynamic, flexible process. So there is no singular way of it, that it operates. It adapts to people. It incorporates different people. If you were to, you know, interview one client and one volunteer set, it would be different from another volunteer and another client set. And I really wanted to try and look at that overarching view. How does it work together, rather than pulling one thing out and saying this part of it works in this particular way? Qualitative, in particular, narrative is able to take quite a holistic view and say this is how it works together, and how all the moving parts sort of rub up against each other or alongside each other or integrate, and this is perhaps how and why, and to tell the story of the biography program almost in a personification, in a way of personifying it itself.
That makes so much sense. I've just come from a meeting with La Trobe Uni where we're about to go into another research project, but it was all about quantitative. And just I'm just thinking to myself, the conversation we've just had, how on earth would you get matching data sets in the biography research? Like, it's just impossible. Yeah. So, yeah, you're absolutely spot on there.
And I think it is a really interesting way also of going into, because you do have quite a number of volunteers, 100 at the moment or thereabouts, and you produce about 100 biographies a year, that given that depth of experience, I was never going to find out everything about that. That's almost impossible to be able to do. But to get an overview of the potential of where it might go, could go, what it can be, and to really offer a perspective that is both an overview but also tells individual stories. And that was quite an interesting dynamic to try and balance within the thesis itself, was to say this is the overview, but then also these are the really specific stories that sort of speak into the overview, and to balance that dynamic. But I think it does offer a really interesting insight into a holistic perspective of the biography program in this instance, but also in other places. I think it could also do the same.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting question. What does the future look like for biography in palliative care, perhaps broadly, and perhaps also for you as EPC specifically?
Okie doke. Well, how
what do you think?
The world is your oyster.
What do you think?
Look, I think the future is very bright. It always has been with this particular program. I think there is a lot more research. So if we look at that side of things, the document you've created, I totally 100% agree, is a great foundational document for us to bounce off. And we might just touch at, right at the end, about where you potentially could see further work could be done. The future is already commencing, to be honest. We've just had our first meeting of what I was calling the National Biography Practice Group, but I can now legitimately call it the International, because we've got 8 organisations joining from New Zealand. So this is a group of other organisations who are all doing the same program. We'll be networking, supporting each other. We've referenced the fact that we've now got a Centre for Volunteer Excellence at EPC, where we now are able to train other organisations in the biography program and mentor them. There's potentials for further networking across the nation amongst the biographers themselves. I've got some thoughts around that and how that might be of benefit. I know there are some groups around Australia who have moved into film as a process of storytelling. I'm intrigued by that, because I think it changes the entire storytelling process and also intent of program, but I'd be interested to look into that a little bit more. It could go on and on and on, really. And a lot of it is going to be constrained by the health dollar as well. Yeah. So if there's any philanthropists who are listening out there, please call Eastern Palliative Care. We'd love to hear from you.
Any appropriate grants
you might know of. Right, grants that are multiple in nature that we could spread across the industry around Australia and overseas. Look, that, you know, I'm hoping that we will be pushing into the international market, and we've already had alerts from London and from Singapore about people who might be interested as well.
Great.
So that's where my brain is currently operating. To flip the question back on you as our last question for the day, the research that you've done, where does it go to, as in what would be your recommendations moving forward?
That's a really hard question in a way. I think there's many possibilities, and it comes down to the choices that we want to make about it. And the, as you said, the money, I think there's a lot of opportunity. I think there is a lot of, as you said, there's a lot of opportunity to look at other variations. So variations on a theme and what that means. I think given that I did do some, I presented drafts of scripts and things like that. And so I think there is also a space to look into how we talk about it, talk about death, palliative care and biography writing in a more public way. How do we do that as a community? And I think there's a space to do that with incorporating theatre and the arts and that sort of stuff. So I think there's quite a lot of opportunity out there. It really does depend on your time, money, headspace, all that sort of stuff. Because I think for me, coming away, having submitted and then having to let it go for a little while and let my brain sort of calm down from that intensive process, only now, a couple of months later, do I really feel like I'm actually able to go, oh, I'm beginning to form better thoughts about how that might happen now. And I think there's some great opportunities. It really depends on where we want to spend our time, or perhaps what's most important immediately, if that's to involve community, if it's to advance the volunteer engagement, if it's to dig into the palliative care experience and the client experience, because that's quite different again. I think there's any number of possibilities.
Including more podcasts.
Wouldn't that be fun?
It would.
Yeah. And that's a very unhelpful answer in many ways because it's not very specific, but I almost feel like I can't be specific because there's still too much in my head about it it would need to be, more direct conversations. But look, if anyone has a theatre space that they'd like to pop on a couple of shows, look, I'd be more than happy to chat about that as well.
We're using this time as our shameless emotional manipulation bids for the money.
but that is part of the issue, and being an artist in other forms as well, part of the issue for the arts is always space.
Correct.
And so space is a really big concern because it's space where you invite people to.
Correct.
And that space to present either theatre shows or discussions or whatever that looks like in practice can be really important, but you do have to get the space, you have to have the space available, and it has to be accessible and structured in a way that invites people into a healthy, happy discussion about a very intensive topic.
Correct.
But, yeah, fantastic. Many possibilities. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Carly. I have enjoyed our 3.5 years together. Yeah. I've really enjoyed, and I know it's not going to end. I've enjoyed this podcast. I've enjoyed working with our sound engineer, Matt.
Yes, thank you, Matthew.
We really appreciate that.
It's been great.
I hope that what we've delivered here is what our listeners have needed to hear. They can, of course, contact yourself and myself in the show notes. We've got all the contact details there. And I'd like to just say it's been a pleasure.
It has been. Thank you. Yes, thank you. It's been wonderful. And I've really appreciated the time that you've put into this. I know that, you have limited time as well, but it's been really great to be able to almost debrief the process with you while also sharing it with other people. So, do get in contact with us if you have any other questions or interest or want to contact EPC about becoming involved in the biography program. This research is supported by a La Trobe University Research Scholarship, funded in part by Eastern Palliative Care Incorporated. It is being carried out in partial fulfilment of a PhD research under the supervision of Dr. Bruce Rumbold, Dr. David Azul, and Dr. Fiona Gardner, and previously Dr. Susan Finesse. The researcher conducting the research is Carly Edgar. You can find out more about Eastern Palliative Care at epc.asn.au. You can find out more about La Trobe at latrobe.edu.au. This has been a La Trobe University podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia, and on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people, and with thanks to Matt Bourne as our recording engineer.